Information discussed in this podcast may be sensitive in nature to some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Gentel Johnson was a fun and likable 15-year-old girl in 2010. She was also a beautiful girl with a bright and contagious smile. Gentel was known for spending lots of time doing her hair and the hair of her friends and family. She even had dreams of owning her own hair salon someday. Somehow, Gentel had become involved with a much older man. She was just barely 15 in late 2009, but was dating a 27-year-old. Much to her shock, she soon found herself pregnant. Gentel came to terms with this news, and after speaking to her parents, she decided to keep the baby with their help and support. It couldn't have been easy for anyone in the family, but they were very close-knit, and they were determined to work through it together. One cold day in February, Gentel's older brother, Prentice Jr., drove Gentel to school. She was a sophomore at Glasgow High School, and she was determined to keep up with schooling despite her pregnancy. Now, Prentice attended a different high school, so he dropped Gentel off and then continued on his way. Around noon, Gentel called her mom to tell her that she was leaving school and walking home because she really wasn't feeling well. Her mom told her that was fine and to go home and get some rest. The walk home was just about a mile. Later that evening, Prentice Jr. arrived home to pick up Gentel and see if she was feeling better to go to their church event that night. He went inside and he found Gentel's purse and her eyeglasses on the counter. There was no sign of Gentel. Gentel hasn't been seen or heard from since. Where is Gentel Danielle Johnson? Hello, and welcome to the Where Are They podcast and another unsolved missing persons story. Gentel's story has always bothered me. For those of you who may have been around since the beginning of this podcast, I first covered her story in early 2021. I have always checked in on her case, hoping for updates. The suspicious nature of her disappearance and the absolute lack of media attention and law enforcement attention on her case is really, really upsetting. Gentel was just 15 years old, a sophomore in high school with hopes and dreams for her future, and that included her baby that she was excitedly preparing for with the help of her family. What happened to Gentel on that February afternoon? Young, pregnant, 15-year-old girls should not vanish into thin air. People just don't disappear. Of course, thank you so much for being here and for listening to Gentel's story today. Someone out there knows where Gentel is. Someone needs to speak up and come forward. Let's keep sharing her story and let's help get Gentel home. Gentel was born in Delaware on September 8, 1994. As a baby, she had these chubby, puffy cheeks, which gained her the nickname within her family of Puff. Her friends in high school also nicknamed her Jay. In 2009, Gentel's family moved from Wilmington, Delaware to Newark, Delaware. Gentel, along with her older brother, Prentice Jr., and her mom and dad. Gentel also had an older sister, Janelle, who was living in the Philadelphia area. Gentel was attending Glasgow High School in Newark, which was just about a mile from her apartment complex. She was a good student. She was a likable girl. She seemed to get along with everyone that she met. Gentel and Prentice were both athletic and involved in sports, and both had a lot of friends. Somehow, and we aren't too sure on the details of this, Jantel developed a relationship with an older man. At barely 15 years old, Jantel began dating a 27-year-old. Not only dating, but in late 2009, Jantel thought that she might be pregnant. She wasn't sure what to do, so she turned to her older sister, Janelle, first. Her sister talked her through the ordeal and taking a pregnancy test, and she was shocked when it came back that she was indeed pregnant. But Janelle assured her that they would talk to their parents together. The meeting with their parents went good. They were shocked, of course. Jantel was barely 15 years old herself. But they asked Jantel what she wanted to do, and Jantel said that she wanted to keep the baby. They assured her that they would support her and help her through it all. Jantel also reassured her parents that she wanted to finish high school. She wanted to go on to cosmetology school. She really loved doing hair, and her dream was still to open her own hair salon. She might even want to pursue business school after cosmetology school. Her family would do everything they could to help with her future goals. The disappearance. On Wednesday, February 3rd, 2010, Jantel was dropped off at school by her brother, Prentice Jr., just as she was every day. But by mid-morning, Jantel would call her mom and let her know that she wasn't feeling good and she was going to head back home and rest for a bit. She had some after-school activities at the school she wanted to go to, and there was also an event at their church in Philadelphia that night that she also wanted to attend. Jantel walked home as the school was less than a mile from her apartment. Her mother never questioned her walking home. Jantel texted her mother to please call or text her and make sure she was awake before her brother arrives to pick her up later that afternoon. Her mother said she would, but when that time came, she continued to call and text Jantel, but received no answers. Her mom thought she probably just fell asleep and wasn't overly concerned. She figured Prentice would have to go in the apartment and probably wake Jantel up. They might be a little pressed for time and a little stressed, but her mother didn't immediately fear the worst. Later that afternoon, her brother, Prentice Jr., arrived to pick her up. He went into the apartment, noting that the door was unlocked, but Jantel wasn't there. He did find her purse, her jacket, and her eyeglasses, and he did see signs in the kitchen that she had fixed herself something to eat, probably recently, so he knew that she had been there. There was just no sign of his sister anywhere. He checked in with family members and some friends, but no one had seen or heard from Jantel since earlier that day. Now, his first reaction was a little bit of frustration. He was supposed to pick her up so they could go on to these events that they wanted to go to, and yet she wasn't there. Why would she leave when she knew he was going to be coming for her? But as he looked around the apartment, he realized something really seemed off. If Jantel was planning on leaving for any length of time at all, she would have definitely taken her purse and most certainly her eyeglasses, which were prescription and which she wore every day. Now, anyone who wears prescription eyeglasses, as Jantel did, knows that if you are leaving to go somewhere, you don't leave behind your glasses. As that evening progressed, with still no signs of Jantel, her mother called the local authorities to report Jantel as missing. Jantel Johnson had disappeared. The search and investigation. Of course, as is often the case in missing teenagers, the authorities believed Jantel had likely just gone off with friends, or possibly even run away from home. They really didn't do anything to search for Jantel. She was 15. She was pregnant. They just truly believed she was a runaway. Meanwhile, her family was frantic. They knew this was not like Jantel. Yes, at one point in the past, she had run away once, But she didn't stay away, and she had always kept in contact with her family. Plus, why would she run away now? Her family was helping and supporting her through this pregnancy. And since she was just 15 years old, she needed them. She needed their help. They weren't having any family issues, and she wasn't having any problems with friends or at school, at least that anyone was aware of. Her family was also quick to notice that it looked like Gentile had just planned to maybe step outside and come right back. Her purse and her eyeglasses were left on the counter, but her jacket was missing. It seemed as if she had just planned to run outside for a minute or two and would be right back. The door to their apartment was also unlocked. The family reported all of this to law enforcement, who did agree to try and obtain her phone records to see who she had talked to that afternoon. Had someone possibly called her and asked her to meet them outside? Detectives said obtaining her phone records would take a while because Gentile had a prepaid track phone. This would make things a little more difficult. Now, at this point, everyone is likely wondering about Gentile's 27-year-old boyfriend. Not much about him has ever been released or talked about, at least publicly. Was he interviewed? Was he questioned? Did he have an alibi? Did he help search for Gentile? All of these are really unanswered questions. Meanwhile, there had been little done to find Gentile, and there were no clues as to where she may have gone. It would be weeks before authorities finally obtained some additional information. Gentile's phone records show that her phone last pinged that afternoon that she went missing in an area of Wilmington, Delaware, actually in a neighborhood where her boyfriend's mother lived. It also showed the last call she made was at 1:38 p.m. that afternoon. Unfortunately, the clues stopped there. Law enforcement has never released any additional information about those phone records. We do not have a call log history. We do not have text message data, or really anything that may be helpful to locating Gentile. Gentile's family struggled to get anyone to pay attention to them and Gentile's disappearance. Law enforcement wasn't too interested in working Gentile's case, and the media wasn't interested in covering the story either. Until finally, one reporter in the greater Philadelphia area did pick up Gentile's story. Claudia Rivero did a short piece for her news station and was captivated by Gentile and Gentile's story and the plight of her family to get help. Claudia began doing her own digging, interviewing family members, touring the area where Gentile lived, and even starting up a website dedicated to Gentile, which you can find at whereisgentile.com. Claudia was one of the few people outside of the family helping and paying attention. Years later, Claudia learned something shocking by finally talking to investigators. She learned that Gentile didn't go to school that day at all. She had actually cut school with a friend. Police also had surveillance video of Gentile at around 12:30 p.m. buying candy at a nearby grocery store that same day she disappeared. In the video, she is seen alone and paying cash at a self-serve checkout line. In 2022, 12 years now after Gentile vanished, Claudia Rivero interviewed Detective Herrera from the Newcastle County Police. Detective Herrera heads up the Missing Person Division and had some interesting things to say about Gentile's case. I do want to play a portion of this interview. Please note, you can find the video interview of this at Claudia's website for Gentile, the one I mentioned earlier, whereisgentile.com. It has, of course, been 12 years now since Gentile went missing when this interview was conducted, but I guess we finally have a member of law enforcement speaking up and talking about Gentile's case, which has provided some interesting information. Take a listen to this clip from the interview.
I took over missing persons in 2018. This was one of the first cases that I look back at, of the old cases. She was 15 years old. She was pregnant, 5 months pregnant. So it's a case that kind of like catch anybody's, you know, attention right away. At this point, still a missing person investigation, and there was no sign of struggle in the apartment, no signs of forced entry in the apartment. There was, she didn't, which is also weird, but she didn't pack. Her clothes were still there. She didn't pack any of her personal belongings. Again, with outside having like any sign of foul play or sign of struggle, there was nothing else just to, you know, investigate this as a missing person case. We got a pretty good timeline for that day. She never made it inside school. So she cut school with a friend. And I guess they were hanging out during the morning. That day in the house, after she's reported missing, we found, it was like a receipt from a grocery store. There was a path mark where she used to live. So investigators back then, they actually went to the supermarket and they actually were able to find surveillance video. We can see her around 12:30 by herself, buying candy, paying cash in one of the self-service lane. We know she makes it home. There is communication on the cell phone. She was talking to several people. And one of the people was also her mom, I think, around 1 o'clock. I think she actually spoke with mom around 1 o'clock that afternoon.
Is that the last time, as far as phone records show, is that the last time she spoke with a family member?
Yes, with the mother. And then after that, there's some texts, there's some phone calls, and I don't remember exactly the time right now, but I'll say 2:30, 3 o'clock maybe. That's when she stopped answering. And then you got a bunch of missed calls, you know, going into the phone.
Are there any solid leads that tell you who may have been responsible for Jontel Johnson's disappearance?
I can tell you that it's not normal what happened to her. We got reports that she's been seen in Ohio, Philadelphia, California. Maybe she was living with somebody willingly. I know that back then, they did a neighborhood canvas in the area, you know, checking with the neighbors to see, and nobody reported nothing suspicious, you know, like any type of struggle outside, you know, the apartment complex or anything like that.
The initial information when Jontel vanished that was released to us, at least when I did the story way back in 2010, was that she was in contact with several people, it was put as several older men. What about those other individuals?
Back then, one of them actually helped through the investigation. He was interviewed multiple times. The other person, I think, initially spoke, you know, but since I took over, I hasn't reached out to any of those three older men that you're referring to.
Was the person believed to be the father of her child, was he among those who she spoke with that day?
Yes, he was among of the people that she communicated. That person, they reached out, you know, he was reached out back then, provided little to no information at that point.
He did agree to talk to detectives?
I don't want to say agree, he pretty much said that he don't want to, you know, talk, so that person has not been, you know, helping back then or still in the investigation.
Now, there's a couple of very interesting things that I picked up on from this interview. Number one, investigators learned that Jontel was in communication with several older men, not just her 27-year-old boyfriend, but there were others. And I have to wonder, how and why was this the case? Jontel was a high school sophomore. She was only 15 years old. What was leading her to communicate with all of these older men? Where was she meeting them? What was going on there? And the other interesting thing I picked up on in this interview was the fact that the father of her unborn child, that 27-year-old, never really fully cooperated with authorities. It doesn't sound as if he ever even gave a full interview. He just declined to speak to them from the start, which is interesting. If the mother of your unborn child goes missing, you would want to move heaven and earth to find them, wouldn't you? It was also learned that her baby's father would later be arrested for domestic violence and assault on a woman that he was in a relationship with. Now, this has nothing to do with Jontel's case from 2010, but Does this show a history of violence, specifically against women? Maybe authorities have now taken the case more seriously. But is it too late? Why didn't they hit the ground running back in 2010? And if they had, would Jantel be here today? Or would we at least have answers on what happened to Jantel Johnson? Newark, Delaware. Jantel vanished from the city of Newark, Delaware, back in 2010. Newark is a small-ish Delaware city. In 2010, the population was just over 30,000 residents. Newark sits in the corner of the state, bordering both Pennsylvania and Maryland. Newark is also surrounded by a large amount of public parkland, over 12,000 acres, in fact. To the south is Iron Hill Park, and to the west is Fair Hill Natural Resources Management Center. And to the north is White Clay Creek State Park and White Clay Creek Preserve. Also, not too far away is Middle Run Valley Natural Area, which is part of the Newcastle County Park System. In fact, the larger city of Wilmington, Delaware, is just 25 minutes to the east and also sits on the very large Delaware River. This is also the city where Jantel's family had just moved from shortly before she disappeared. Philadelphia is an hour and a half to the north. We do know that Jantel's family traveled often to Philadelphia, her mom for work and her family for church services. It's also believed that her older sister, Janelle, also lived in the Philadelphia area. 45 minutes to the south is Baltimore, Maryland. Jantel's apartment complex, Autumn Park Apartments, is located just down the street from Jantel's high school, less than a mile. It doesn't seem that they had any CCTV footage there, and since it is believed that Jantel likely left that immediate area, probably by getting into someone's car, that certainly could have been a big help to the investigation. But you have to wonder, if they didn't really hit the ground running investigating Jantel's disappearance, did they even look for additional CCTV footage? By the time they had, it may have been too late. There does seem to be a small pond to one side of the complex and a larger lake across the street. But in reality, Jantel went missing in the middle of the day during broad daylight. In a very highly populated area, the apartment complex she lived in specifically had a lot of apartment buildings. Authorities do believe it is most likely that she was taken out of the area. And in fact, that's what her family believes also. They believe she was kidnapped and is likely living somewhere in the Philadelphia area or in New York. I have also heard reports that she may have been taken to Florida, but I'm not sure where that information originated from, or even if it has any merit. Theories and possibilities. So what are the theories and the beliefs in Jantel's case? There really are just three main thoughts. Number one, was Jantel a runaway? She had run away once before, and initially, police just believed she had done it again. She is listed in the missing persons database as an endangered runaway. And really, this is actually the most hopeful of the three theories we'll talk about. But after 15 years, hope for this one seems to be dwindling. Her family also maintains that there was no reason for Jantel to run away. They were a happy, close-knit family. They were very supportive of Jantel's pregnancy. But some have to wonder, because of the pregnancy, did Jantel want to run away? Did someone convince her to run away? Number two, kidnapped. Is it possible that Jantel was taken against her will? Maybe by the baby's father, or maybe by one of these other adult men that she was talking to? Maybe they were afraid of getting into legal trouble for being with Jantel in the first place. So maybe they took her and she had her baby somewhere else. Maybe she was even kidnapped by a complete stranger. Her family believes she was taken without her consent. Her family believes she was taken against her will. They don't believe Jantel would have left on her own accord. And if she was taken against her will, they can only hope that she is living somewhere, being taken care of, and raising her baby. Number three, foul play. Did Jantel meet with foul play after no sign of her for many years? This is also, unfortunately, a possibility. However, there have been no signs of foul play found anywhere during the police investigation. And if something did happen to her, where is she? If this is what really happened to Jantel, we can only hope that someday someone will talk and the family can have the truth they so desperately need. They need and deserve answers. What do you think happened to Jantel Johnson? What else can we do to help her case get more exposure? Why isn't her story talked about more? Jantel was last seen with her hair in braids and may have been wearing a black ski jacket with a fur-trimmed hood, blue jeans, and sneakers. She is described as a black female standing 5'2" and weighing 120 pounds when she was last seen in February 2010. She was also 5 months pregnant at that time. Jantel has a scar on her chin just below her lip. There are some age progression photographs available online that show what Jantel might look like today as a young woman. If she was able to have and keep her baby, she would have an almost 15-year-old child today. If you have any information that may lead to Jantel Johnson or any information at all regarding her case, please call the Newcastle Police Department at 302-395-8171. Thank you so much for listening to Jantel's story today. Her case needs a lot more attention than it gets, and we can all work together to make that happen. Please continue sharing Jantel's story. Jantel's mother said that Jantel had an upcoming appointment right before she went missing, that week, in fact, to find out if she was having a boy or a girl. She thinks of her grandbaby all the time, wondering if she has a granddaughter or a grandson out in the world. Jantel's family has spoken out criticizing the lack of coverage for Jantel, and they aren't wrong. Only one reporter really covered Jantel's case at the time, and that was Claudia Rivero. So a huge shout out again to Claudia Rivero and her work on getting Jantel's case out there. I'll link her website in the show notes. Ashley Summers was a lovable, easygoing child growing up in Cleveland, Ohio. As she entered her teenage years, however, Ashley developed a bit of a rebellious streak. At 13 years old, she also began dating a 16-year-old, something her family definitely didn't approve of. Ashley also began to fight daily with her stepfather. Ashley, with a large and close-knit family in the area, would go to stay with her grandmother for the summer of 2007. Her grandmother lived in Cleveland also, as did several of Ashley's aunts, uncles, and cousins. Even though Ashley wasn't staying at her mother's house at this time, she still stayed in touch with her mom daily. On July 9th, 2007, Ashley's mom, Jennifer, couldn't reach her daughter on her cell phone that day. She began to call around to different family members and see if Ashley might be with them, or if they knew where she possibly was. The next day was spent trying to find Ashley. Since Ashley had been having some rebellious issues as of late, her mom first believed that she was likely with a friend or with one of her cousins. Ashley's family also learned that on the morning of July 9th, Ashley had had an argument with her uncle, which resulted in her cell phone being broken. This explained why no one could reach her and why no one was hearing back from her. Finally, after not being able to track down her daughter for several days, she called authorities to report her as missing. Unfortunately, as we see with a lot of teenagers in these cases, law enforcement took the report, but they listed her as a runaway and they didn't do anything to find her, at least in the beginning. There would be some occasional sightings that would come in of Ashley, but Ashley remained missing. Where is Ashley Nicole Summers? Hello, and welcome back to the Where Are They podcast and another unsolved missing persons case. Ashley Summers vanished in 2007, but authorities believed she was a runaway and they put very little effort into her case. This always baffles me because she was just 14 years old, still very much a child. Even if she had run away, she could still be in danger and at risk on the streets. Are we just supposed to let these children live on the streets on their own at age 14? I'll never understand why these cases get dismissed as much as they do. These children are vulnerable out there in the world. They are susceptible to things like human trafficking, and they're at risk for drugs and crime as they try to find a way to live on their own. They still need our help. We should not label them as runaways and then just ignore it. In the case of Ashley Summers, I truly don't believe she was a runaway. But even if she was, this young girl needed help, needs help. Before we get into Ashley's story, I want to give a shout out and a welcome to Christina, our newest Patreon member. Thank you so much for joining us, for supporting us, and helping us share as many of these stories as we can. A reminder, you can find all of our social media links in the show notes, as well as my contact information. Please feel free to reach out anytime with any feedback or case suggestions. Now, let's get into the story of Ashley Summers. Ashley Nicole Summers was born on June 16, 1993, in Cleveland, Ohio. She was the first child of her mother, Jennifer, and she was surrounded by many aunts, uncles, and cousins, all whom lived nearby. Eventually, Jennifer would go on to have four more children, and Ashley loved being a big sister. She enjoyed taking care of them and playing with them, and in turn, they all looked up to her too. Ashley also stayed close to her mom. They had a very tight relationship. Jennifer referred to Ashley as her best friend. They went shopping together. They loved staying up late and watching television together. But as Ashley grew into a teenager, she became a little rebellious, something that is really not that unusual for a lot of young teenagers. She began talking back a little, and her mom caught her taking money from her purse. And the final straw was when Ashley decided to sneak a boy back to her house. When her mom found out, she was furious. Ashley wasn't even 14 yet, and her mom felt she was much too young to be dating. The boy she was seeing was a 16-year-old boy from the neighborhood, a boy named Gene. Ashley and her mother began to butt heads even more, and in the summer of 2007, after Ashley came home with a tattoo of Gene's name, they decided together that Ashley should go stay with her grandmother for a while. Now, as I mentioned, Ashley had a very close-knit family. They all agreed that they would all look out for Ashley and help each other. They all lived on the west side of Cleveland. Many of the cousins and relatives walked to each other's houses often, and they always spent a lot of time together. It seemed like a good idea for Ashley to go stay with her grandmother for a bit, and yet Ashley's mom could stay in touch with her and see her regularly. Although the summer of 2007 started out a little rough for Ashley and her family, they did have hopes that things would get better and that they could continue to do all of the fun summer activities that they always do, such as go to amusement parks, having cookouts, and staying up late. And for a short time, things were going well. Ashley seemed to be doing better at her grandmother's house and being a little bit more respectful. The disappearance. In July 2007, Ashley was bouncing back and forth between her grandmother's house and her Uncle Kevin's house. Uncle Kevin was the house where many of the cousins gathered to hang out. It seems that Uncle Kevin was that cool uncle, and everyone wanted to spend their days there. His house was also close to several other family members within walking distance. The dates of these next events are up for debate, different files referencing different dates. For instance, the Charlie Project says the date in question was July 9th, 2007, but the FBI files state it was July 7th or July 8th. And Wikipedia has it as happening on July 4th, 2007. But whichever date it was, this is what happened. That morning, Ashley spent some time swimming in a relative's swimming pool. She would also argue with her Uncle Kevin that morning, which somehow resulted in her cell phone being broken. Around 6 o'clock p.m., Ashley decided to leave her Uncle Kevin's house and walk to her aunt's house, which was about a mile away. The interesting thing is, Ashley took her backpack with her belongings. Meanwhile, that day, Ashley's mother, Jennifer, had been trying periodically to reach Ashley, but Ashley wasn't answering. And this was really not typical, and Jennifer was becoming frustrated. The next day, she continued to try and reach her daughter, on and off all day, and still no response. Jennifer's frustration was turning into worry. Jennifer called Kevin to find out what was going on. Kevin told her that Ashley had left the night before to walk to an aunt's house and that she didn't have her phone because it had been broken. Jennifer checked in with the aunt, but she told Jennifer that Ashley had never come over at all. As her worry began to grow, Jennifer reached out to Gene, the boy Ashley had been seeing. Gene said that he hadn't seen Ashley in a while. He'd actually been out of town at a family reunion. The family started calling around to other family members and friends to try and track down Ashley. At first, they believed she must just be with a friend, maybe even a friend that they don't know. Ashley was known for bouncing all over. Jennifer was concerned that Ashley had not found a way to reach out to her yet, even though she didn't have her phone. The entire family would spend a couple of days searching on their own before finally deciding to call in the authorities and report her as missing. Ashley Summers had disappeared. The search. Authorities took the information regarding Ashley's disappearance, but they didn't put too much effort into it. Because of her history told to them by family members, they believed her to be a runaway and she was listed as such. Law enforcement did speak to Gene, who again confirmed that he was out of town at a family reunion. It seemed to be Ashley's family that were the ones pounding the pavement searching for Ashley, handing out flyers, and hanging them up all around their West Cleveland neighborhood. As the weeks went on, however, they noticed something weird was happening. As soon as they would put up these missing person posters and flyers, somebody was going behind them and tearing them all down. Why would someone be taking Ashley's missing person posters down? In August, just a month after Ashley went missing, her mother received a phone call from an unknown number. The caller simply said something like, "Hi, Mom, it's me. I'm fine." And then hung up. For some reason, that call wouldn't be attempted to be traced for several months. In November of 2007, Ashley's grandparents were driving through Cleveland when they saw a young girl walking on the side of the road. Something about the way the girl was walking and her mannerisms caught their attention. As they were watching the girl, this girl turned around to look at them, and her grandmother's heart stopped. It looked so much like Ashley. The girl held their gaze for a minute as they passed, leading them both to believe that it might have been Ashley and she recognized them. They quickly turned the car around to follow this girl, but she had turned down a side street and vanished. The young girl had short blonde hair instead of the longer brown hair that Ashley had. However, the family had been hearing rumors of Ashley living on the streets and that she had cut her hair short and dyed it blonde. Since the girl disappeared and they couldn't find her, they would never know if it was indeed Ashley. Finally, after almost a year of no clues and very little movement in her case at all, the FBI finally got involved in Ashley's case. It is speculated that the events happening in Cleveland were what drove the FBI to get involved. In 2003, Amanda Berry, a 16-year-old West Cleveland teenager, vanished while walking home from work. The very next year, 2004, Gina DeJesus also went missing from the same neighborhood also where Ashley Summers lived. Gina was just 14 years old, the same age as Ashley. Did West Cleveland have a serial kidnapper on the prowl? Were these disappearances related? The FBI were the ones that wanted to try and trace that phone call her mother had received almost a year ago. But too much time had gone by, and Jennifer couldn't remember the exact date that that phone call happened. But finally, it seemed authorities were taking Ashley's disappearance seriously. It seemed something was going on in Cleveland, Ohio. May 6, 2013. This is a date that will live on in Cleveland, Ohio's history. On the morning of May 6, 2013, Angel Cordero heard screaming coming from outside their Seymour Avenue home. They went outside to investigate and they found a young woman crying out for help. Angel, however, didn't speak English and couldn't understand what this girl was asking for. While this was happening, another neighbor saw the commotion and came over to help. This man, Charles Ramsey, called 911 for the girl. This girl told him that her name was Amanda Berry and that she had been missing for 10 years. Law enforcement converged on the scene and discovered two other grown women living in the home and a child. They found Gina DeJesus, who had been missing since 2004, and another young missing Cleveland woman, Michelle Knight. While Gina and Amanda's story made the news regularly, and all Clevelanders knew the names Amanda Berry and Gina DeJesus, people were not as familiar with the story of Michelle Knight. Major news networks from all over converged on Cleveland, Ohio as these girls were rescued. Ashley Summers' family had often thought her disappearance might have been connected to Gina's and Amanda's, and when they heard about this discovery, they hoped that maybe this would bring their Ashley back. This home where this was taking place on Seymour Avenue was less than 2 miles from the area where Ashley vanished from. Their hope increased even more when they were told that a third unidentified girl had been found. Rumors quickly began to circulate that it was Ashley Summers. Sadly for the Summers family, however, that would turn out to be not the case. As the young women were freed, a man by the name of Ariel Castro was arrested for their kidnapping. Castro was also the father of the young child found in the home, a child he fathered with Amanda Berry. This horrific event has been covered extensively, and Castro would end up taking his own life while in custody. There was never a trial. The home at 2207 Seymour Avenue would end up being demolished. In 2015, another lead came in when a photo went viral of a girl at an ATM machine in Rhode Island. This girl's photo was being pushed all over the news to try and identify her, and as soon as those in Cleveland saw it, they believed it looked just like Ashley. Even family and some law enforcement agreed. However, eventually the girl would be tracked down, and it was determined she was not Ashley Summers. The next big event in Ashley's case occurred a couple of years later. On December 4th, 2018, Kevin Donathan, also known as Uncle Kevin, was arrested and charged with rape and battery. He would be convicted and sentenced to 35 years in prison. Kevin admitted guilt in those charges, but he is steadfast when he says that he had nothing to do with Ashley's disappearance, as some have accused him of. Law enforcement did end up searching Kevin's home and property, but turned up no sign or no evidence of Ashley Summers. Authorities have said that he is not a suspect in her case. Another investigation took place at West 43rd Avenue and Train Avenue, where authorities conducted a search and a property dig. They did find some bones there, which once sent to the lab, they were determined to be animal bones. Nothing else was found during this search, and the FBI has not said what led them to search that particular area. West Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland is a very culturally diverse city that sits on the banks of Lake Erie. It is known for its restaurant scene, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and the professional sports teams of the Cleveland Browns, Cleveland Cavaliers, and Cleveland Guardians, to name a few. The city is culturally diverse with all ethnicities and all religions. Currently, the population of Cleveland sits at just over 350,000 residents. The city is easily separated by the Cuyahoga River, with the west side of the river being known as the West Side. This is where Ashley lived with her family. When she first disappeared, her file noted that the last sighting of Ashley occurred at West 96th Street and Madison. This is a residential area with some small businesses filtered throughout. The walk to Lake Erie from this intersection would be an easy one, about 2 miles, to get to Edgewater Beach, a very popular swimming beach and park. Being that Ashley's disappearance took place midsummer in broad daylight, there had to be people out and about everywhere that day. People had to see Ashley. After Uncle Kevin's arrest, the FBI took another look at Ashley's case. They determined, from what they call a credible source or credible evidence, that Ashley's last known whereabouts were not actually 96th and Madison, but rather West 44th Street and Trowbridge. This area is completely residential, and it's about 3 miles from 96th and Madison. West 43rd and Train Avenue was the area where investigators conducted that dig search, but only unearthed animal bones. This part of town is mostly residential again, with some railroad tracks running along one side. We don't know exactly what led the FBI to that particular area. Cleveland is no stranger to crime. It is also no stranger to runaway teenagers. From NeighborhoodScout.com. With a crime rate of 60 per 1,000 residents, Cleveland has one of the highest crime rates in America compared to all communities of all sizes, from the smallest towns to the very largest cities. One's chance of becoming a victim of either a violent or a property crime here is 1 in 17. Authorities in Cleveland state that they receive several reports of missing children each week, and over 90% of them are found in the first 24 hours, most of them being runaways. They also claim they don't have the manpower and resources to devote to each case as it should be, leaving families to do a lot of the legwork themselves. This is something that is not specific to Cleveland, however. This is pretty much every large police force in the country. The questions. Authorities haven't said much in the way of what evidence or information they do have on Ashley Summers' disappearance, but I have many questions. Not much has really been followed up on regarding the boyfriend. Has he officially been cleared? If Ashley's last sighting was indeed West 44th and Trowbridge, who was it that saw her there? Was she alone? Did she have her backpack with her? Which direction was she walking? Have any of her belongings ever been found? Does Uncle Kevin have any additional information on who she might have been with or where she might have been going, seeing as she never made it to her aunt's house that night? What do you think happened to Ashley Summers? Do you think she ran away, or is it more likely that she ran into foul play, or maybe even had an accident somewhere and we just haven't found her? Ashley is described as a Caucasian female standing 5'5" tall and weighing around 130 pounds when she was last seen in July of 2007. She had shoulder-length brown hair and blue eyes. It was believed that she was wearing a black shirt, blue jeans, and white sneakers. Ashley has a tattoo on her right arm of a heart with the name Jean on it. That's Jean spelled G-E-N-E. Ashley was 14 years old when she went missing and would today be 30 years old. Anyone with any information on the whereabouts of Ashley Summers is asked to please contact the Cleveland Police Department at 216-623-5005. Brittany Beers was born into an unstable family life. She was a playful child, but her first few years were plagued with neglect and abuse. Although sadly, actions were not taken right away to protect her or her siblings. In 1997, 6-year-old Brittany enjoyed riding her bike and playing outside. They lived in an apartment complex in Sturgis, Michigan, and Brittany always had someone to play with. Sometimes it was her older brother, a younger sister, or even just a friend in the neighborhood. It was from this neighborhood that little Brittany would disappear after going outside to play. On September 16th, 1997, Brittany and her older brother were outside riding bikes. Around 8:30 p.m., their mother Tina left to run some errands. When she returned, she asked Brittany's brother to find her so they could come inside for the evening. It was a school night. He soon came in to tell his mother that he couldn't find Brittany anywhere. She had simply vanished. Her discarded bicycle was the only thing left behind. Her story may sound strikingly similar to another case, the case of Amber Hagerman. Amber was kidnapped in 1996, just 1 year before Brittany, and was tragically later found deceased. Her parents and advocates fought for legislation to change how missing children cases were handled, and soon we had the official Amber Alert. While Brittany's story initially sounds a lot like Amber Hagerman's, you'll find that it might actually be very different. For one, Brittany, a young 6-year-old child, is still missing, a little girl who went outside to play as she had done so many times before, only this time to disappear into the night. Where is Brittany Ann Beers? Hello, and welcome back to the Where Are They podcast and another unsolved missing persons case. The story of a missing child is particularly heartbreaking, and this episode may be triggering if certain topics involving children and abuse are sensitive to you. Our goal is to share these stories and help bring awareness to these unsolved missing person cases, especially those that are flying under the radar. By being here and listening to these cases, you are helping their names reach more people. For that, I thank you. I also want to welcome a couple of new Patreon members. A big welcome and thank you to David and Teresa J for joining our Patreon group and supporting our mission over there. As always, the links to our Patreon, all of our social medias, and my contact information can always be found in the show notes. Now let's get into the story of Brittany Beers. Brittany Ann Beers was born on August 1st, 1991, to mother Tina Stettler and her father, Raymond Beers. While the details of that relationship are unclear, the family dynamics in the next few years would be complicated, to say the least. It does get very confusing, but I'll try to keep things as clear as I can. When Brittany was just 3 years old, a babysitter believed that Brittany was being molested by her stepfather at the time, Kevin Folsom. Folsom was also the father of her half-brother. This was reported to authorities, and Kevin ultimately confessed to the crime. In 1995, Kevin was sentenced to prison, and he would remain there until 2008. In 1997, Brittany was 6 years old now and was living at the Village Manor apartment complex with two of her siblings and her mother, Tina, and her father's brother, James Beers. Her mother and her uncle were taking care of the kids, while Brittany's father and an older sister lived across town. It was just said that the relationships were complicated. Brittany already had a confirmed record of abuse, and neighbors at the Village Manor apartments believed that the children may still be being abused in the home. They would see the kids outside all the time, looking dirty and unkempt, and often telling others that they couldn't go home because their mother locked them out. It is unclear if anyone tried to report this. In August of 1997, Brittany began attending Fawn River Elementary School, and she thoroughly enjoyed going to school. She enjoyed playing with the other children, and her favorite activities would be anything that was arts and crafts related. Going to school was likely a time where Brittany could escape the struggles at home and just be a kid. At least, that's what I hope school was for her. In early September 1997, James Beers was arrested for domestic violence, allegedly throwing a bottle at Tina. He would be released soon after, and he would return home. It seemed the family life would continue to be tumultuous. The disappearance. Tuesday, September 16th, 1997, was a typical day at school for Brittany and her siblings. After dinner that evening, Brittany and her brother would go outside to play. It was around 7:30 p.m. when they first went out, and they would have a little bit of daylight left to enjoy. By 8:30 p.m., despite it starting to get dark, Tina left to run to the store and allowed the kids to keep playing outside. She saw Brittany on her bike as she drove off and waved to her daughter. Shortly after Tina left, Brittany was seen by her brother sitting on a park bench. She was sitting alone. Tina arrived back home just after 9 o'clock p.m. and asked her son to go get Brittany and tell her that it was time to come inside for the night. A few minutes would go by before her brother came running back inside, saying that he couldn't find Brittany anywhere. Tina went out to search as well and started asking anyone if they had seen Brittany. One neighbor said that he thought he saw her just before 9 o'clock p.m. talking to someone in a red or brown vehicle. This neighbor said that Brittany then came up to him after and said that she had, quote, made a new friend, end quote. The neighbor didn't really think anything about it and went about their business. That is, until they realized Brittany was missing. All that could be recalled was that the man was in a red or brown vehicle and that he had a mustache. During the search of the area around the apartments, Brittany's bicycle was found abandoned, with no sign of Brittany anywhere. By 10:30 p.m. that night, Tina officially reported her daughter as missing. 6-year-old Brittany Ann Beers had disappeared. The search. Authorities quickly responded. Brittany was just 6 years old, and by now it was completely dark out. If she was out there, she could be lost or injured, and she was probably terrified. When her bike was discovered abandoned, however, everyone quickly thought about a case from the year prior, a case that had received a lot of media attention and many people were already familiar with. That is the case of Amber Hagerman. Amber was 11 years old on January 13, 1996, and she was out riding her bike when she was abducted. Her bike was found abandoned, but Amber was missing. 4 days later, however, Amber's body was found in a nearby creek. She had been brutally murdered. Amber's case remains unsolved to this day. Amber's story takes place in Arlington, Texas. Nowhere near Sturgis, Michigan, but Amber's case was known nationally. Her case would go on to bring legislation enacting the Amber Alert for missing children. Brittany was younger than Amber, however. She was only 6 years old, but her bike was found abandoned, and it was believed that she might have been abducted, just like Amber. Searches were conducted around the entire apartment complex, and bloodhounds were brought to try and track a scent. The dogs led authorities to a parking lot of a nearby convenience store where the scent seemed to stop. The store was not far from the apartments where Brittany and her family had lived, and it was located on a main road. If Brittany had made it to the store, why hadn't anyone seen her? Was she alone? There was no surveillance video to help answer some of these questions. The searches spanned out across 40 acres. Brittany was 6 years old and often played in nearby fields and on railroad tracks. Storage buildings and sheds were searched as well, but again, nothing was found to lead to Brittany. It seemed as if she vanished into thin air, which led everyone to believe that she must have been abducted. The disappearance of little Brittany Beers caused her family to be put under the microscope, and quickly they found themselves under investigation by Child Protective Services. A few days after Brittany disappeared, James Allen Beers, Brittany's uncle, who was living with them at the time, was arrested and put in jail for domestic violence. Child Services, after learning about more possible abuse happening in the home, removed Brittany's brother and sister from the home, and said that if and when Brittany is found, they will petition for custody of her as well. Now, at first, they did try to work with Tina in an effort to help her regain custody of her children. They told her that she was to have no contact with James and that she was to get and keep a job. Sadly, Tina refused to leave James. Therefore, CPS, Child Protective Services, permanently removed her children from her custody. By age 6, Brittany had likely been abused at home by a few different people in her life, people who were supposed to be loving and protecting her. If we do believe the theory that she was abducted, possibly by a man with a mustache in a red or brown vehicle, it's easy to see how she may have been lured away simply by showing the little girl some attention and care, which she must have certainly been yearning for. Every year, vigils are held on the anniversary of her disappearance. Grandparents are known to travel across the country to attend these, but Tina hasn't attended any of them since the first one in 1998. The first big break came when a suspect in another case was arrested. The first big break in this case would come when a suspect in another case was arrested and photos of young girls were found on his computer. One photo resembled Brittany Beers quite a bit, and authorities felt it warranted a further look and investigation. For a while, everyone was on pins and needles waiting to find out if it was Brittany. The photo was ultimately determined to be a young girl from Texas and was not Brittany Beers. In 2007, Jody Parakhi, a young 11-year-old girl in Michigan, was brutally murdered. Her murder went unsolved for several years. In 2015, a young 10-year-old girl ran to authorities and reported an attempted abduction. She would lead law enforcement back to a man's home, and Daniel Furlong was arrested. During this arrest process, his DNA was entered into the system. Suddenly, there was a hit. His DNA was a match to the DNA found on Jody Parakhi's body back in 2007. He subsequently confessed to the murder, pled guilty, and was sentenced to life in prison. He stated that he picked Jody at random, as he had the second girl he abducted. Jody's body was found in Constantine Cemetery in Constantine, Michigan, which is about 15 miles from Brittany's home in Sturgis. Authorities are not sure if there are more victims, but many feel the girls he was drawn to seem to resemble Brittany. At one point, detectives had drawn up a composite sketch of the man the neighbor believed he saw talking to Brittany, and there was a strong resemblance between Daniel Furlong and the man in the sketch. Could he also be responsible for Brittany's disappearance? He never confessed to having anything to do with Brittany, and he maintained his innocence right up until he passed away in prison in August of 2024. Authorities have said he is still a person of interest in Brittany's case. Sturgis, Michigan. Sturgis, Michigan is known as the Electric City. Sturgis was home to the electric company that powered the Sturgis Dam in Three Rivers, Michigan. The dam is about 20 miles away from the center of Sturgis in the Village Manor Apartments, where Brittany and her family lived. The dam sits on the St. Joseph River. Michigan is a northern border state bordering Canada. It's also considered part of the Great Lakes region, with the state of Michigan itself sitting in between Lake Erie and Lake Michigan. Sturgis, specifically, sits on the southern border of the state, not far from Indiana. There are several bigger cities within a few hours' drive, including Chicago, Indianapolis, and Detroit. Sturgis is the largest city in St. Joseph County, with a population of around 11,000 residents. It's a small-town feel in Sturgis, but they are no stranger to crime. The crime rate in Sturgis is considerably higher than the national average across all communities in America. NeighborhoodScout.com rates the city with a 17, meaning it is safer than only 17% of similar-sized U.S. cities. Brittany lived with her family at Village Manor Apartments on Laura Drive in Sturgis. This apartment complex houses hundreds and is located right off of Highway 12, which runs east and west. You can take Route 12 east all the way to Detroit, and then west all the way to Lake Michigan. Easy ways to get in and out of the area. As for waterways, there are several small lakes and rivers, in addition to the nearby Great Lakes, of course. 6 miles away is the larger Thompson Lake, and of course, the rivers that run through that area, which helped power the region with the large hydroelectric dam. The apartments that Brittany lived in were located in a residential area with a road, Laura Drive, that runs straight through. Someone can drive in one side and out the other without having to turn around to exit. This neighborhood is on the east side of the city, and as you travel further east on Route 12, the area quickly becomes more desolate and rural. Brittany went missing in the evening time after 8:30 p.m. It would have been dusk or close to being completely dark. However, there were likely streetlights in the area. Could Brittany have gotten into a car willingly and no one would have noticed? Certainly, had she been yelling or screaming, someone probably would have heard due to the proximity of all those apartments. Could she by herself have walked to a nearby convenience store? That's where the scent dogs did track her to that parking lot. Maybe somebody walked with her there. The disappearance of Brittany Beers has remained one of the biggest unsolved mysteries of Sturgis, Michigan. However, despite the importance of the case, many in Sturgis, new residents and old, have never heard of Brittany Beers. Theories and possibilities. What could have happened to 6-year-old Brittany Beers? There are a few main thoughts in her case. Number one, stranger abduction. There were some questionable people in the area at the time of her disappearance, including the man who had photos of children on his computer, and of course, Daniel Furlong. Daniel Furlong was convicted of the abduction and murder of Jody Parakis, a young girl who was found deceased in 2007, just 15 miles from Brittany's home. He also very closely resembled the composite sketch of a person of interest in Brittany's case. Although they have no evidence that Daniel Furlong abducted Brittany or had anything to do with Brittany, they were never able to rule him out completely. He has since died in prison, but he maintained his innocence in Brittany's case right up until his death. I definitely have to say he does resemble the sketch a lot, but he was quick to confess to Jody's murder and the other attempted abduction, even proudly boasting about how he was able to do it. If he was involved in Brittany's abduction, I think it would have been likely that he would have also confessed. It may have also been another abductor that took Brittany. Brittany was often outside alone and not closely monitored, even at just 6 years old. A predator may have seen a crime of opportunity and took it. Number two, a family member. Brittany's childhood, all 6 years of it that we know about, was marred with abuse. There was confirmed sexual abuse and confirmed family neglect. Her mother, Tina, would also lose custody of her other two children shortly after Brittany's disappearance. Could it have been a family member that took Brittany, or worse, harmed Brittany? There are many who do believe that this is likely what happened. No one can argue that the family situation was complicated. If Brittany was harmed, however, in the home, where was she taken and by whom? Some believe that Brittany may have been taken in an effort to give her a better life. I think it's very possible that something could have happened to Brittany at the home. Statistics aren't in favor of the family here. But statistics aren't evidence, and there is no evidence that something did happen to Brittany at the home. And I have to wonder, if she was taken to provide her with a better life, would we know that by now? Brittany was taken at age 6, but she would be in her 30s now. Number 3, a runaway. Certainly, if Brittany was experiencing abuse at the home and was left alone for long periods of time, running away could be considered an option for any missing child. However, Brittany was really young. She was just 6. Even if she had successfully managed to run away at first, it's doubtful she would have been able to stay away, at least without any outside help. I do have a hard time buying into this theory, if nothing else, but for her age. What do you think happened to 6-year-old Brittany Beers? Brittany is described as a Caucasian female with blonde hair and blue eyes. She was last seen on September 16, 1997, outside her apartment complex in Sturgis, Michigan. She was last seen wearing a white tank top or t-shirt with a floral design, pink tie-dyed shorts, and white sneakers with a pink design on the sides. Her shoelaces had a red stripe down the center. She was 6 years old when she vanished, and she would today be 33. Anyone with any information on the case of Brittany Beers is asked to contact the Sturgis Police Department at 269-651-3231. Janiyah Walker was enjoying her newfound summertime freedom on June 23, 2022. School was out for the summer, and Janiyah had a new job lined up at the local Milwaukee pizza shop called The Pizza Shuttle. Janiyah had recently turned 15 years old, and a summer job seemed perfect for this young girl. A young girl who had been struggling with some depression and some PTSD, but with regular visits to a therapist and a new job to help keep her spirits up, Janiyah's future looked bright. Janiyah is described as a quiet and shy girl, so working at the pizza shop may help her come out of her shell and give her some summer spending money. On the morning of Thursday, June 23rd, 2022, Janiyah's mother, Tanisha Howard, went in to say goodbye to Janiyah before leaving for work herself. Janiyah was lying in bed and told her mom that she would text her later. Throughout the day, the two exchanged a few texts. This was normal behavior. Janiyah and her mom spoke all throughout the day, every day. So when Janiyah suddenly went radio silent that afternoon, Tanisha was immediately concerned. Janiyah's father was scheduled to pick up Janiyah at 3:30 to take her to get her worker's permit finalized for the pizza shop. He showed up for his daughter, but he couldn't find her anywhere. She wasn't home and she wasn't answering her phone. He called Tanisha, who would come home and help search for their daughter. After not finding any signs of her that afternoon and into the evening, Janiyah was officially reported as missing. Janiyah had seemed to vanish into thin air. Where is Janiyah Walker? To the Where Are They podcast and another unsolved missing persons case. The story of Janiyah Walker is terrifying. It's scary that something or someone can maybe lure away our teenagers into the unknown. It's scary that they could walk away from their homes and never be seen again. Did Janaya run away? Was she lured away? Some clues in her case will make you wonder. Her story reminds me a lot of Alicia Navarro and maybe even Michaela Bali or Asia Wilbon. If you aren't familiar with their stories, they are all teenagers who seem to plan to leave their homes, either by being persuaded to do so or for some other reason. Alicia was found alive living in another state when she turned 18 years old. Michaela has not yet been found, and Asia Wilbon has not yet been found either. There are so many stories just like theirs. Teenagers lured away from their homes and never seen again. Teens who could be in grave danger, and parents who spend all of their waking moments searching for their children. Thank you for being here, for being a listener of the show, and just helping us spread awareness and spread the word about these unsolved disappearances. Janaya Walker was born on May 15, 2007, and grew up with her family in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Janaya was the baby of the family, and because of this, she was often called by her nickname, Baby Girl. Her mom, Tanisha, describes Janaya as quiet, shy, soft-spoken, and angelic. She is also extremely intelligent and smart. Janaya does suffer from some depression and PTSD, and she did have a therapist to help her through these times. Being 15 years old can be hard enough, but it sounds like Janaya had some additional struggles. It also sounds like her family helped her and provided her with much love and support to get her through these times. Janaya had a new job lined up, and with regular visits with her therapist, she was taking steps towards a bright future. By all accounts, it seems they were doing everything right. The disappearance. On the morning of June 23rd, 2022, Tanisha Howard walked into her youngest daughter's bedroom to say goodbye before heading to work. Janaya was still in bed, but awake, and she said she'd call or text her mom later. Janaya had no plans that day, at least until 3:30 p.m., when her dad would come pick her up so they could go get her work permit finalized for her new job at the pizza shuttle. Throughout the day, Janaya and her mom spoke via text a few times. This was normal behavior. The two were very close, and they talked often. Until suddenly, Janaya stopped responding to her. Tanisha was instantly worried and felt something was wrong. Sometimes teenagers don't always immediately respond to their parents, but not Janaya. Tanisha had that motherly intuition kick in that something wasn't right. Meanwhile, Janaya's father shows up as planned at 3:30 p.m. to pick up his daughter. First, he texts her that he is there waiting for her. He receives no answer. He tries calling, also no answer. He knocks on the door. He is met with only silence. He calls Tanisha at work and asks her where Janaya is. When he explains that he is there at the apartment, but he can't find her, nor can he reach her by phone, Tanisha's concern for her daughter escalates. She comes home and starts looking for Janaya. This is extremely out of character for her daughter. Looking around the home, she sees nothing out of the ordinary. When her parents can't find Janaya and her phone continues to go unanswered, they call the Milwaukee Police Department to report their 15-year-old daughter missing. Janaya Walker had disappeared. The search and investigation. Authorities responded to Janaya's apartment and took the missing person report from her parents. Of course, since she was 15 years old, law enforcement believed her to be a runaway. And while she very well may have been, her parents were not backing down in the search for Janaya. If she had run away, she would have had to have had help. She didn't have much or any money. And with her very shy and quiet nature, she wouldn't make it out in the streets alone. After some sleuthing on both the investigators' part and Janaya's family, they learned a couple of important details. First, Janiyah is caught on a nearby Ring doorbell camera at around 2:30 p.m. This neighbor was near the intersection of East Reservoir Avenue and North Buffum Street. Google Maps tells me this is a two-minute walk from where her apartment was located over on East Brown Street, so it's likely that she'd left her home just before 2:30 p.m. The image of Janiyah is clear enough to tell it's definitely her and to easily identify what she's wearing and, most importantly, what she is carrying, an army green large backpack. Tanisha said she has never seen that backpack before. However, the more she thought about it, she recalls Janiyah receiving an Amazon package a couple of weeks prior. The package was large, and Janiyah told her that it was for an upcoming camping trip. Tanisha thought that was a little strange, but dismissed it and ultimately forgot about it until that moment of seeing Janiyah on the Ring camera. Was that backpack one she had received in the mail just a couple of weeks earlier? Janiyah is not the type to run away, but had she planned this? And if so, why? They did not discover any additional video of Janiyah, but they were able to learn that Janiyah did send a text message to her therapist at 3:27 p.m., a text that said she was running away. There are a ton of unanswered questions here. Did the therapist ever indulge any additional information? Could they even indulge it? And very importantly, what about Janiyah's cell phone records? She clearly had her phone with her. Can her movements be tracked? Was her GPS tracking her? Can we tell who she was in communication with? I do suspect authorities might have some of this information, but it has never been shared with the public. As days turned into weeks and then months, there were no additional clues as to Janiyah's whereabouts. No one heard from her after that 3:30 text message to her therapist. No one saw Janiyah after that 2:30 Ring doorbell video. No one that has spoken up anyway. Sade Robinson. 2 years later, in April of 2024, a young 19-year-old by the name of Sade Robinson vanishes. Sade lived in the same area of town as Janiyah, and coincidentally, or maybe not, Sade worked at the Pizza Shuttle, the same one where Janiyah was starting her summer job. In fact, it was said that Sade had actually started training Janiyah right before Janiyah disappeared. On April 1st, 2024, Sade goes on a first date with an older man, a 33-year-old Maxwell Anderson. They go to dinner at the Twisted Fisherman, head to a nearby bar afterwards for some drinks, and then they head over to his place. Sade doesn't come home that night or the next day, and friends and family can't reach her. Authorities are notified, as this was not typical behavior for Sade. That same day, April 2nd, a passerby finds a human leg bone at a local park and calls the police. An investigation into those remains begins at the same time as a missing person investigation continues for Sade Robinson. It is quickly learned that that leg bone belongs to Sade, and her car is soon found burned near 29th Street and Lisbon. Surveillance video catches Maxwell leaving the scene, actually walking away from the burning car. Maxwell's apartment is searched and Sade's personal items are found, along with some blood evidence. The rest of Sade's remains would be found along a remote beach on Lake Michigan. Maxwell Anderson is arrested and charged with first-degree intentional homicide, mutilating a corpse, and arson. His motive is unclear at this time, although authorities have announced that they do believe that he had planned Sade's murder for a few weeks leading up to their date. His trial is scheduled for December of 2024, and I'm sure we will learn more details as that date nears and as the trial commences. So I'm sure you are wondering, what exactly does this have to do with Janiyah? Is there a connection to Janiyah? Or why are we even talking about Sade in Janiyah's story? While many people do believe that they could be related, even though they happen 2 years apart, first, Janiyah and Sade are both young, very attractive Black females who lived in the same area of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Both girls worked at the pizza shuttle when they disappeared. There was unidentified blood found in Maxwell's apartment, blood that matched neither Sade or Maxwell. Many do believe that Maxwell had likely had other victims. I agree, there are suspicious circumstances here. The only thing that gives me pause is how Sade was murdered and found. If he had done something like this before, would he be so sloppy in his killing of Sade and disposing of her car, belongings, and ultimately her? Sade's story is horrible and tragic and shouldn't even be a story. This should never have happened. There was no reason to kill this beautiful young woman with her whole life ahead of her. No reason at all. And I pray that we have justice for Sade and her family very soon. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Milwaukee is Wisconsin's most populated city, located in the southeastern corner of the state. In 2022, the population was around 560,000 residents. Milwaukee sits on the shores of Lake Michigan, the second largest, volume-wise anyway, of the five Great Lakes. It's also the only Great Lake that does not share a boundary with Canada, and it remains 100% within the United States. It is a massive water source. Janiyah was specifically from the 400 block of East Brown Street. From there, she was seen walking south towards the river. Then she vanishes. No one has come forward reported seeing her after that. So did she get into a car? Looking at the map, she's about 2 miles from a Greyhound bus station. Could she have made it there and gotten onto a bus? Did she even have an ID to do so? But again, no one reported seeing her get on a bus there either. Milwaukee is also known for having a much higher crime rate than similar-sized U.S. cities. Neighborhood Scout rates Milwaukee as a 2, meaning that it is safer than only 2% of other U.S. cities. Not a good rating. They also state that your chances of becoming a victim of a violent crime in Milwaukee is 1 in 66. However, Milwaukee police have announced that there have been great improvements in crime rates throughout the years. Specifically, murders and carjackings have decreased in the last few years. But there is one category that has increased significantly since 2022, human trafficking. In fact, from 2022 to 2023, human trafficking increased 43% in Milwaukee. And that's what we can identify. Certainly many trafficking situations go undetected. This big increase happened starting in the beginning of 2022 and carried on through the end of 2023. Janiyah vanished in June of 2022, right in the throes of this epidemic in Milwaukee. Could Janiyah have been a victim of human trafficking? So what do you think happened to Janiyah Walker that day? Did she run away? Was she lured away? Is she still out there? Is she in need of help? Or did someone bring her harm? Is there a possibility that Maxwell Anderson could be connected to her disappearance? We must keep sharing Janiyah's story. Someone out there knows something, and it is very possible this girl is out there and in need of help. It didn't seem there was any reason for her to run away from her family, and if she had chosen to do so for whatever reason, I'd hope that she would have at least contacted them at some point to let them know that she is okay. But she hasn't, and that is extremely troublesome. Janiyah is described as a Black female standing 5'1" tall and weighing around 110 pounds when she was last seen on June 23rd, 2022. Janiyah was 15 years old then and would today be 17. She was last seen on that video surveillance, that Ring doorbell camera, wearing a green Adidas t-shirt, blue jeans, and blue and white shoes. She was also carrying that mysterious large green backpack. Janiyah wore her hair in long braids the day she left, and she has brown eyes. Anyone with any information on the whereabouts of Janiyah Walker, please contact the Milwaukee Police Department at 414-935-7405. Anyone in need of help with human trafficking, I urge you to contact the Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-888-373-7888 or visit humantraffickinghotline.org. You can also show your support to the family by following along on her Facebook group they set up for her. You can find that by searching Janiyah Walker Missing. Help us find her. Thank you for listening to Janiyah's story today and helping us raise awareness about her story. Her family continues to hope and pray for answers, and I hope they get them soon. The not knowing is pure agony. If you have any feedback for us or case suggestions, please reach out to us on the socials. All of those links can be found in the show notes. Or you can email me anytime at canwefindthem@gmail.com. I want to give a huge welcome and shout out to Maria, our newest Patreon member. Thank you so much for joining us and supporting our mission. Patreon is where you can find bonus and subscriber episodes, as well as ad-free versions of our regular weekly episodes. The link to our Patreon can also be found in the show notes. If you are interested in more missing person cases, be sure to follow the blog over on our website at wherearethepodcast.com. You can also find our contact info there and all of our past episodes as well. Thank you again for listening to Janiyah's story today. A young girl whose family is left wondering what happened to their daughter, their sister, their friend. Someone out there has to know something. We will be back again very soon with another unsolved missing persons case. And until then, stay safe and hug your loved ones.